Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Learner's Corner podcast. My name is Caleb Mason, and I'm so grateful that you have decided to spend a few minutes of your day here with me in the Learner's Corner. And today I am honored to be joined by returning guest to the podcast, Dr. Nijay Gupta, to talk with him about his brand new book, Strange Religion: How the First Christians Were Weird, Dangerous, and Compelling. And, you know, if this is your first time listening to the podcast, we want to create a safe place to have difficult conversations. We want to create a place to where you can continue to learn and grow and explore and follow your curiosity and just learn about so many different aspects of just life. And, you know, one of the things that I do from time to time is learn about ancient history. And in this case, it is the early church as well, and learning really how the Roman Empire operated, how it affects us today, and what we can learn from that as well. And so if you are on this lifelong journey of learning, as I am, please subscribe to my Substack, to where I just give different recommendations for some of the best things that I'm learning from, whether it be works of fiction or YouTube videos or songs or movies or TV shows or literally anything that is just engaging my curiosity and making me think as well. Now, as I mentioned today, I'm talking with Nijay, and you know, I really enjoyed talking with him about a year ago about his book, Tell Her Story, which is how early women in the church, you know, led and were involved and participated in the church as well. And so whenever I saw this book coming out, I really wanted to talk to him again because I really enjoyed our conversation. Now, let me tell you a little bit about him, and then we can jump and do my conversation with him. Dr. Nijay Gupta is professor of New Testament at Northern Seminary. He is the co-host of the Slow Theology podcast, founder of the Crux Sola blog, and has written numerous books, including Tell Her Story, A Beginner's Guide to New Testament Studies, 15 New Testament Words of Life, and commentaries on Galatians, Philippians, Colossians, and 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. He is also the co-editor with Scott McKnight of the State of New Testament Studies, and a senior translator for the New Living Translation, and he currently lives in Portland, Oregon. And without any further wait, here is our conversation. Nijay, it is good to have you back on the Learner's Corner podcast today.
Thanks, Caleb. Good to be with you again.
Yeah. And, you know, just as we're getting started, one of the places that I love beginning conversations is I love hearing the origin story behind things. And so you have authored this new book called Strange Religion. And I would just kind of love to hear, where did this idea of learning about the first Christians and exploring them in this way begin for you?
Great question, and it does help get to the heart of the book. The kind of academic origins lie in some conversation I had about a book I wrote called Paul in the Language of Faith, where I look at the Apostle Paul's use of language of belief, faith, trust, all of that. And I had, and I say in the book, Christians didn't call themselves Christians in Paul's time, for most of Paul's life, I assume. They called themselves brothers and sisters. They called themselves saints or holy ones. And they also called themselves believers. And so someone asked in a lecture once, a very thoughtful audience member asked, did other religious people at the time call themselves believers? Because didn't everybody believe in something? And I never heard that question before, never thought about it. And so it took me on kind of a journey to look at other religions of the time, like Roman religion, which I focus on in the new book. And, you know, first thing I noticed was they don't actually talk about belief very often because they take their beliefs for granted. And Roman religion would have been the state religion that everybody just accepted as the way things are. Like, you know, when people are, you know, become citizens of the United States, they don't ask you, do you believe in the president? It's just the president's the president. and whether you believe it or not. And it's kind of like that way of the Roman gods. And so I thought, oh, that's interesting. Okay. And then I want to look more into the ways that Romans thought about religion. And I came across really fascinating. What I tried to do is I tried to just spend like a year away from biblical studies, away from Christian literature, and only reading primary sources in Greek and Roman texts from the ancient world and the writings of modern historians of ancient Rome, Greco-Roman world, classics. And I found this interesting discussion where two or three different ancient historians of ancient Greco-Roman world say that Roman religion wasn't a faith, it was a science. Now, when they say science, they don't mean like how babies are born or like material science and physics. They mean the way we think of scientific experimentation, that if I do these specific things, I will get this outcome. And Roman religion didn't operate based on faith. Like, I'm going to pray to God. If we have this relationship, this, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. It was this idea that if I do these rituals in this very specific way that's been passed down from generation to generation, then we will get a specific answer from the divine realm, or we will be able to make contact with the divine realm, or we will appease the gods. And so it's really fascinating, this idea that Roman religion was based on what one scholar calls empirical epistemology, meaning facts, not faith. So then what are these Christians doing coming along talking about faith? And you have to realize Roman religion was very visual: sacrifices, priests, temples, locations, statues, very visual. They didn't have religious texts the way that Judaism and Christianity has religious texts. And so there, everywhere you went, you know, just like St. Paul goes in the book of Acts, goes to Athens and is horrified by a city full of idols. What does that mean? He sees statues of gods everywhere. And then Christianity comes along, middle of the first century, and they don't have temples. They don't have priests. They don't have sacrifices. They don't have cult statues. Their God is invisible. Their patron deity, Jesus, is not on earth and can't be seen after his ascension. And that got me down this track of thinking, how could Christianity ever have emerged in that world? It is the most unlikely thing to have ever happened in terms of what was normal for the time. That's kind of so that got me excited. Well, if they're weird in these ways, are they weird in other ways? I found out they're weird in every way.
Yeah. And I definitely want to talk about more of that. One of the things that I was thinking about today was I was actually thinking back to a quote that you introduced me to in our last conversation, and it's "The map is not the territory" by Alfred Korzybski.
You're probably saying it better than I would. I love that quote.
Yeah, me too. I have not been able to stop thinking about it since the last time that we talked, and it got me thinking about, you know, we all probably have our ideas of how the early church like lived out, played out, all of these things, but that's not necessarily, that may not be like our ideas of how they actually lived things out may not be actually how they lived out, you know, going back to that.
Yeah.
I would just be very curious to hear from you. What are some of the ideas that you've heard that we tend to have about the early church that are either like true or false in terms of how things actually played out in the early church, if that makes sense?
Yeah, a lot of it isn't, a lot of my book isn't telling you brand new things about Christianity as much as telling you things you didn't know about the Roman world that help you understand how much Christians deviated from the norm. Mm-hmm. So for example, the idea of equality, the idea of the dignity of every individual human being, the inherent dignity or worth. That was not a Roman value, right? The whole concept of slavery is built on this idea that some people are worth more than others, right? Think about sports today. It's crazy. It's not crazy, but we do this in sports where we actually put a dollar figure on an athlete and say, this person is worth more because of how fast they can run, or how good they can do at scoring points, or saving goals, or whatever it is. We put and think about that, but if that was everywhere all the time, right? And that's a Romanized way of looking at the world, is that people are put in categories of importance. Here the Christians come and they say, neither Jew nor Gentile, slave or free, male or female. And Paul says this crazy thing. Colossians says, no barbarians. What's a barbarian? A barbarian is an outsider, an outgroup person. And typically that was a foreigner, a person from a foreign culture. And the absolute epitome of Romanness is when people come to our state, our empire, they conform to Romanness and they become like us. They dress like us. They talk like us. They look like us. They value what we value. And people that don't conform to that are barbarians. And this actually comes from the Greek word barbarianos, which was actually an onomatopoeia for making fun of someone's language. You'd say, I don't know what they're saying. They're saying bar. And that's a way of saying, your learning your language is not important. Learning your culture is not important. Your culture is not as important as my culture. And what happens with Paul is he says, no, there are no barbarians. There are no Scythians, which would be our way of talking about like rednecks and white trash, mm-hmm. right? We would label people, there's white trash, And Paul's saying, no more. We don't label people that way. And we don't understand the degree to which that is just a completely different way of thinking. So I don't feel like, I mean, you would have to tell me what in the book struck you as odd. But what I really want to do is set the stage for Rome. And I was just talking to someone yesterday, and they said, I liked your book, Nijay, but they wished I had actually compared to Roman culture to modern American culture. Because for as much as we talk about the effect of Christianity on Western civilization, the positive effect, we also need to talk about the effect of Romanness on Western civilization and how we might be living in a new Roman era of, think about Hunger Games, think about Star Wars, imperial hegemony, cultural hegemony. So I don't know if you want to come back to me with things where you're reading the book and you were like, Christians were different. they were just very different. I mean, I would say an immediate one that comes to mind is N.T. Wright was asked 5-10 years ago, if the Apostle Paul could be put in a time machine and brought into 2023, 2024 America, and he was able to visit 100 churches across the United States, what would be a common observation he would make, maybe a critique? And Wright always gives the same answer. He says, the church is divided and we don't care. Or even more now, we're proud of being divided. And I think Paul, now the first century churches weren't perfectly unified. I have a whole chapter in my book called The Christians Were Not Perfect. So they were not unified, but the apostles, the great leaders, Jesus, James, taught radical unity and community. And that we will not peacock against each other and puff ourselves up against each other, and that we need to be intentionally not doing things the way the world does in terms of how we treat each other. That to me would be something I would think really stands out. One of the questions at the heart of my book, I hope you picked up on this, although I don't say that, is would our spiritual ancestors recognize us today as their spiritual descendants? Mm-hmm. I'd say mostly no.
Talk to me a little bit more about that.
I mean, let's just talk about worship. Worship would be a pretty key, it's a key part of my book. And it's actually something that I think to some degree early Christians and Roman religion had in common against modern worship, is that in the ancient world, whether you were Christian, Jewish, Roman, whatever, worship wasn't privatized. It wasn't about feel goodness. And it wasn't optional. And yet that's often how we treat religion today. I can't make it to church, or I don't pray very much, or church isn't doing it for me, or And I get that. I've had phases like that. I understand people's frustrations with church, but in the first century, you didn't worship the gods because you felt like it. You worshiped the gods because it's the way the world works. They are the leaders and we are the followers. So it's kind of like if my kids came to me, I've 12, 15, and 17. It'd be like if my kids came to me and said, "Dad, I don't feel like listening to you today," or "I don't feel like doing my chores today." That wouldn't go too well, Caleb, in our house, because it's not, it doesn't come down to what you want. It comes down to you're a child, I'm a parent, and I know better than you, and I'm trying to help you, but you need to do what I tell you to do. And for the early church, they understood worship wasn't about music, even though music is a form of giving worship. It wasn't about giving money or listening to a teaching. Worship is about recognizing the value of the one that stands over you in leadership and authority, and reinforcing that and appreciating them. And I feel like that's a big difference, because I feel like a lot of Christians go to church today wanting to get something out of it. And so that could be a teaching, or that could be a feeling, or it could be a skill. But the ancients, I think they worshiped because they recognized that God is God and I am not. That's the starting point, I think, of ancient religion.
You know, I'm going to ask a question, and I realize that the answer might be no to this, but I kind of want to ask like the inverse of what we were just talking about in terms of like, hey, our spiritual ancestors, you know, are disappointed in how Christianity is living out or how we're following Jesus today.
Yeah.
Is there any like encouragement or like, hey, this is a good way in which we are living it out?
I think that they would recognize that we have changed systems that they didn't, like slavery. So there are ways where they would realize, oh my gosh, yes, that's pretty bad. Yeah. Or, you know, some of the hate speech that the New Testament uses around judgment, things like that. I think some of the ways that we've tried to address that and be mindful and caring about that, I think they would see kind of the errors of their ways. One thing that I just have been thinking about lately, it's not in my book, is how much our emotions are tied up with our theology and our Christian life and our growth as a human being. My wife is a therapist, and the need for therapists is just off the charts. She has a gigantic wait list. And what we're learning right now in 2024 is that people are not doing well. A lot of people, including myself, I have a person I go to every month that helps me navigate the troubles of my life. People aren't doing well, and the ancients didn't have sophisticated ways of dealing with that. Now, the moral philosophers had some things, but we've advanced culturally over 2,000 years to where we can address psychology issues, psychotherapy, all this stuff. We start thinking about wellness and mindfulness. I think the degree to which we're able to do that, I've spent time in a Quaker context where they have great practices of silence, solitude, simplicity, things that kind of clean up the gunk in your life.
Yeah.
I think the ancients would appreciate the ways that we have tried to put a magnifying glass and microscope to some of those things. So I'd say, I don't want to be a complete curmudgeon, Caleb. I am really concerned about the modern Western church, the modern American church. I've lived in a lot of cities across the United States, Boston, near Cleveland, Seattle, Portland, Philadelphia, parts of New York, in upstate New York. And so I've seen a good amount of American Christianity, and I'm worried, I guess is the way to put it. I'm worried. Yeah. Worried for my kids.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I completely agree with you. And I think that's kind of why I was curious to hear, is there anything like, are there any bright spots in it? Because sometimes it feels like there aren't. In that.
We go in waves. Well, we go in waves.
There are
beautiful things happening all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, and that's why, you know, I put the caveat on at the beginning. I was like, hey, I know the answer might be no.
No. I'm taking it as a very polite pushback, and I take that because, I mean, it's kind of like not universal. The positives aren't universal. The positives are pockets of really beautiful things happening. For example, ministries and churches to people with disabilities or with chronic pain, divorce recovery groups, substance abuse groups, AA and its origins and things like that. They didn't have that stuff in the ancient world. And if you were disabled or I deal with chronic pain, there was nothing for you except, you know, saying your prayers to get some healing, have the elders come over and anoint you with oil. But to have the resources we have now, it's just a question, is our churches availing themselves? Are they prioritizing these kinds of things?
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to go back to, I can't remember who you said mentioned it, but you were in a conversation with somebody about how the Roman Empire has influenced Western civilization today. Yeah. I would be curious to hear one or two of those threads that has influenced how we are today from the Roman Empire.
I mean, the Roman Empire, the Romans were not very original. They were great at perfecting things that already existed. So the Greeks were the artsy fartsy creatives, right? And the Romans, they just tried to monetize everything, make it more powerful, expand. They were the kings of expansion. So I'd say, you know, the essence of Romanness is systems of power, tiers of power. So everything in life today where there are tiers of access, right? If you pay this amount of money, you get to be in the front row. If you pay this amount of money, you're in the middle. If you're then you're in the back. That's all Roman. I mean, it's not only Roman, but Rome said, let's monetize the heck out of this. You know, it's any of the apps we have that you think is free and then you realize I have to pay money to actually get the good stuff. The example that comes to mind a lot, because I end up traveling a lot for work, is airplanes, right? Theoretically, you could just have an airplane where you buy a ticket and you get on the airplane and everyone pays the same price because it's the same tube going to the same place. But we have this brilliant idea that we're going to put the rich people in first class with where they know your name. I've flown first class before because I get upgraded sometimes because I fly so much. So I know what it's like, and it's really cushy, but I feel terrible because I also know what it's like to be in coach. But we're going to let the few, and you're going to walk by them. That's probably the most Roman thing, is they're not in the back, they're in the front, so you walk by them. And it's the weirdest thing. I've been in first class. Again, I don't pay for first class. I've never, let this be known to your listeners, I've never paid for first class. It's the most embarrassing thing for me, because I consider myself one of the people, right? Hoi polloi. Yeah. But I'll take it if it's given to me. Yeah. And to sit in the front row and then people are walking by, someone elderly, someone with small children, someone with whatever, you know, challenge they're having. And here I am sitting cushy. Anyway, very Roman. So what do our churches do to stigmatize and to stratify, which is to create these tiers of power and importance, right? We, you know, back in the old days, this is, you know, the 19th century, 18th century, 19th century, you had churches where you'd have to pay for your pew. And maybe the nicer pews would cost more. And some people, rich people, would buy multiple pews they'd never use in case they had a guest. And then other people would be standing in the back without a seat because they can't afford it. And then my tribe is Wesleyan Holiness. I taught at three different Free Methodist schools. The Free Methodists, have you ever heard of the Free Methodists, Caleb?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
They're the Free Pew Methodists. Their original name came from Free Pew Methodists. And so the whole idea, now it was Christians that at first gave in to the monetized system, but then to say, hey, we're going to give away church for free, we're not going to monetize that sort of thing. Rome loves the pyramid scheme, mm-hmm. where you have the most powerful and the fewest at the top, so that there's a sense of privilege and there's a sense of haves and the have-nots. And then as you go down, the highest population is in the have-nots category. And society is built to reinforce keeping those people at the bottom and to keep a small group at the top. And yet everybody wants to move upwards. Social mobility, right? Economic mobility, political mobility. And what you do then in that society is if there's so few spots at the top, well, then you're going to compete. It's called an agonistic culture. Agon meaning conflict. So it's in an agonistic culture, then you mudsling because you want your group to be more popular than the other person's group. Caleb, do we ever do that as Christians where we sling mud because I want more followers on social media and I know that's the way to get it? Guess where we got that from? Got that from the good old Romans. They were good at that.
Yeah. Oh, man. Man, I don't think I'm going to be able to unsee that framework now, which
Yeah.
I very much
I thought you were
appreciate.
going to say, I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight. It's like, okay, it's true. You
Well,
might not.
yeah.
Read the Sermon on the Mount, you'll feel better.
Yeah. One of as I was going through the book, one of the aspects of Roman culture which really like I felt like I saw it in a new light was the blood and smoke chapter that you write
Yes.
about, because I think I had painted a picture of what I thought ritual sacrifices look like. And then through your own writing and through some of the stuff that you reference in your research, it's like, oh, there's a lot more blood than what you think took place in these sacrifices. Would you mind just elaborating just on that blood and smoke dynamic some
Sure.
more?
Yeah, I started the chapter by saying, kind of to the modern reader, what does worship smell like? Right? And to me, if I step into a church, it's going to smell like carpet cleaner or coffee or someone's cologne. And so it'll be different answers for different people. But in the ancient world, there was one answer. Smells like smoke and blood. That's it. We all know what that smells like, and we all know it's a bad thing in the modern world. But in the ancient world, it would be extremely common. And so I don't know if I could pull up the statistics, but when an emperor is coronated, they will kill tens of thousands of animals in sacrifice. And so you're talking gallons upon gallons upon gallons of blood. And then you're burning up all this animal meat, and we know what it's like to cook a grill. And when I start my grill up in the spring, I gotta burn off all the gunk. And so it's just plumes of smoke for like half an hour as I'm cleaning it up. Well, just imagine that all the time. So you go anywhere near a sacrificial site or a temple, it's just a fog of smoke. And I kind of like the smell of smoke if it's like steak or something, right? So it's not necessarily bad, but you just smell it all the time. And blood, just so much blood because a lot of material sacrifice happens, chickens and goats and cows and all of that. What's fascinating though is Christians didn't have this. Now you might say for 30, 40 years, Christians worshiped with the Jerusalem temple. Yes, but not everybody could go there. Very few people had the means. And Gentiles had really no motivation to go there. And so when we're talking about worship that happens in the house churches, we don't have any evidence that Christians made sacrifices. So you're not smelling, imagine smelling something all the time and then you don't smell it anymore. Right? Just and so when it would be if you invited a neighbor to a Christian meeting, your Christian meeting in the first century, I think that would be an observation they would make. They'd be like, why is there no cooking going on? They're like, the only cooking going on is the dinner, right? And so maybe they might be smelling the dinner, but they wouldn't smell the blood. This was very deviant behavior. Sacrifice was the norm. I've heard about Quaker churches. This would be unprogrammed Quakers, where they don't have a sermon. And sometimes they just sit in silence and then they leave. How weird would it be for kind of a traditional, evangelical like myself, having grown up in the Midwest and in regular evangelical churches, to visit a Quaker meeting where they look at a candle and they pray and they meditate and they leave. That's kind of like what it would have been like for a Roman neighbor to visit on a Christian meeting. They'd say, when does the worship start?
Yeah.
Like, it's over. We did it.
In your year of researching about the Romans and everything, I would be very curious to hear, and I know that you referenced some of it about their like their science and different things like that. What was something that surprised you in your research about the Romans, whether it was like a particular, discovery or like particular quote or just something yeah. like that, that was just stunning.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I dug deep into the question, what are sacrifices for? Right. And I was surprised how Greek and Roman scholarship treats the issue versus Jewish scholarship focused on Judaism. Because when we read the Old Testament, we have all kinds of explanations of sacrifices, you know, for atonement, that sort of thing, and gifts that people bring to God, like Jesus says, put your gift down and then go to the. But the conversation is different in Greco-Roman religion. And there was one scholar that I referenced in my book. His name's F.S. Niden. He has a great book which influenced the title of that chapter called Smoke Signals for the Gods. And his argument is sacrifice had nothing to do with atonement because Greeks and Romans didn't really think of sin as the reason they worship, or they didn't use the language of salvation in the ways that Jews and Christians did. They didn't have covenants. They didn't have covenantal breaches. So what was sacrifice for? And Niden argues it was to open up a line of communication with God, with the gods, with Olympus. And so I kind of think of it like putting a quarter in the payphone, right? So I grew up in the 80s and 90s. And so when I went to a basketball game at my high school, when I was a freshman, couldn't drive, I'd have to use the payphone, call my mom, tell her to come pick me up. Or I'd do the collect call and they say, what's your name? And I'd say, come pick me up. And then I'd record that name and then she'd come pick me up. Anyway, so it's the kind of quarter in the machine. So you made a sacrifice basically to, as a gift of goodwill before you engage with a deity, of saying, hey, I'm going to ask you for a favor, but first, have you ever smelt this cut of beef? It's really good. You know, you might like this. And you did it often because for the sake of keeping the gods happy, showing that you're willing to give up something that's precious to you, because animals were very precious. They were sometimes food, but more often they were animals of labor. So it'd be like giving up your car or your favorite pair of shoes, right? Things that utilitarian things. So sacrifices are always happening because this is what the gods need in order for you to show that you want to appease them. You want to keep them happy. There's a phrase, a Latin phrase, des, meaning I give so that you may give in return. So it's a gift in hopes of return. Kind of quid pro quo, but quid pro quo is a requirement, and this is more of a gift. Mm-hmm. Well, what I found really fascinating is why did sacrifices not happen with Christians? Now, we could say it's all about atonement, but Greeks and Romans aren't going to understand that. They're not going to get that. So I think a better explanation is, yes, Jesus dies once for all to pay a penalty for our sins, but why don't we just make sacrifices of, you know, bread and, you know, Slim Jims, you know, why don't we just make other kinds of sacrifices to God? And here's my theory, and this gets at some of the imagery that's used in the New Testament. Think about, I don't know how old you are, but do you remember the era of dial-up internet?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay, there you go. So with dial-up internet, every time you want to go on the internet, you got to dial up. So you're using your phone line basically to get on the internet, which is super slow. And so you have that pings and bongs that happen, the sounds when you're dialing up. And then when you're done, you have to end it so that you can use your phone again. And it was really tedious. It was slow and tedious, you know, bing, bing, bong, bong. But then think about what I have now. I'm pointing outside to my wires here. Fiber optics, where it's always on. Well, what happens to Jesus Christ for Christians is that Jesus himself opens up a living channel and he makes a position of grace and favorability. I was just reading in Hebrews, let's approach the throne of grace. The one thing that Hebrews wants to tell us about the throne of God is a throne of grace. So we may ask for mercy and receive grace. right? So Jesus opens up once for all a channel, just like fiber optics, of grace. We don't have to pay the quarter. We don't have to do the sacrifice, because we don't need to go into prayer with, how do I get on God's good side? How do I make him like me today? No, because of Jesus, God always likes you, when Paul talks about the intercession of Christ. Because of Jesus, God is always favorable. The channel's always open. It's a pretty powerful difference in an understanding of sacrifice and worship that the Romans and Greeks, I think, if they could put their head around it, would find really endearing.
Yeah. You know, I want to go back to something that you mentioned, and you mentioned how in Christianity and in following Jesus in our theology, there is a space for emotion in that mm-hmm. too, and how they can be entangled. I would be very curious to hear, how did Romans view emotion?
Yeah, good question. So, I mean, there would be views across the spectrum, from just cold utilitarianism, just get the job done, to which you see in the Stoics, the moral philosophers, the Stoics. They were anti-emotion, but they were worried that if we don't accept fate, if we don't accept duty, then we're gonna get carried away. You know, Rome appreciated love in the right context, which is usually family and friendship. They appreciated anger in the right context, which is usually war. they appreciated fear in the right context, fear of the gods. But they would mostly say, let's not let that get out of control. What I find interesting about the early Christians was probably one of the biggest differences between Roman religion and early Christianity was the paradigm of how they understood the human-divine relationship. Rome understood it primarily as a political relationship. The gods are the colonizers, and we are the inhabitants. And we do their bidding, and we grovel, and we kneel. And if we get on their good side, then we're going to get promoted. And you keep your keep your distance from the gods. It would be kind of like, you know, I'm about to do taxes here in the next couple of months. You know, when I'm filling out my forms and stuff, I'm not thinking about how much I love the IRS. I'm thinking I have to pay taxes. It's something I have to do. If I want to live here, I have to pay taxes. And that's how Romans saw the relationship with the gods. They would say, I got to pay my dues. If I'm going to live here and not be, you know, struck with wrath or invite terror upon Rome, one of the key things I say in one of my early chapters is Roman religions was for the sake of Pax Deorum, peaceful coexistence with the gods. So you just want to keep them happy. And then the Christians come along and they shift the paradigm away from government to the family. And they say, we relate to God not like a subject to an emperor, but like a child to a parent. And emotion is normal in that situation. And one of the things I find fascinating is Greco-Roman religious documents or prayers don't talk about the heart. It's not, except maybe devotion or duty. But Christians love talking about the heart. Now, the heart wasn't separated from the mind. They're almost synonyms. But the interior life. The interior life was crucially important to the earliest Christians. They talked about God looking at the heart, that God tests our hearts. He wants to know that we love him with all of our hearts, all of our soul, all of our might. This deep internal commitment. Love language is all over the place in the New Testament, and it was basically nowhere in Roman religion. You didn't use that. There was some sexual things that happened, you know, with a God who might appear as a human to sleep with a beautiful human. You would have these mystery religions where you try to have these ecstatic experiences with a kind of foreign or fringe deity. But in terms of your everyday relationship with Jupiter or Neptune or Mars, it's not love. Mm-hmm. It's duty. It's submission. And with the Christians, yes, they talked about devotion, duty, discipline, but primarily and at the center, they talked about love and joy and peace and hope. things that we associate with personal, intimate relationships.
I was going to say that brings to my mind this other idea that you talk about, and it's how out of place this idea of fruitfulness is as well.
Yes.
Would you mind just talking a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, so often my chapters were kind of hunches, and then I'd research them, and this kind of was a hunch that paid off. Christians today, right? We love talking about growth. Mm-hmm. I want to grow, right? I want to, even the language of godliness, right? This person's a godly man. That was blasphemy in the Roman world, because the whole point of worship is you're not a god, so why would you be godly? You're not Christ, so why be Christ-like? You're not a Messiah. But Christians had this whole other way of thinking that, you know, it's funny, you know, it's still early in the year, so I'm in my get fit mode, and I love the phrase out of shape. I'm out of shape. Isn't that, that's just something we learned to say, but think about that. There's an ideal shape, and I am out of it. Right? And it may be not a universal shape, but certainly what my ideal shape, I'm not in it. So you think about like a cookie cutter mold, and you think you just have a blob of dough, and then you have a cookie cutter mold, and you want to get it in the right shape. Well, Christians kind of had that mindset about humans because of sin, because of Adam, because of the flesh. Humans are out of shape physically, emotionally, epistemologically, the way we think, the way we understand the world. And part of what happens in Christ, in the Spirit, with God, with the gospel, is that we are pushed like a magnet, or pulled like a magnet, into conformity to a shape that we're supposed to be, which is the image of Christ, Colossians 1, right? And Rome had no interest in this whatsoever. Like, there was no connection between religion and morality. There would be a connection between religion and loyalty, the one virtue attribute that would be the most repeated is loyalty. But loyalty can actually make you immoral, right, if you're following the wrong person. But the Roman philosophers actually critiqued popular Roman religion for not being moral. And there was a famous Stoic, Marcus Aurelius. You may know that name from the movie Gladiator. But Marcus Aurelius wrote some philosophical writings, and he said, instead of praying, kill that person, I should be praying, how may I not want to kill that person? You know, that sort of thing. So there were some things like that out there, but the Christians from day one and across the board believe that Christian life was meant for a particular formative end that we call maturity or fruitfulness or godliness. And I think that would have been a powerful attraction for people that looked around the world and said, things aren't looking so great. Even though we have a wealthy empire, the people around me don't do good things.
Yeah.
And I wish there was something I could find where the people are on some track to become good and honest. So some of the critics of early Christianity, like Pliny, reported back to the emperor. He investigated, reported back to the emperor saying, here's what I've learned. They get up early, they sing songs to this person named Jesus, and they make these weird oaths like, I'm not going to steal, and I'm not going to, you know, and he thought that was weird because religious people don't do that. Everyone was religious, but people don't do that. They don't make these oaths. They're not going to like steal, or they're not going to like cheat each other out of money. And this actually later on, Justin Martyr, another early Christian, says too, when he defends Christianity, he says, I dare you to prove any accusation against us, any moral accusation. You have to prove it, but I dare you. And he basically says that to them. He's like, we do actually more for the people around us than anybody else. And that was just not a feature of Roman religion.
Yeah. You know, I got two of the things I want to ask you about. But before that, is there anything that we haven't covered, you know, pertaining to our conversation, or just anything on your mind that you want to make sure that we talk about?
Not really. I mean, it's tough to talk about the whole book. So yeah. I think we're giving people a taste of the book.
Yeah. Okay. So one other aspect of that, I love your subtitle, how the first Christians were weird, dangerous, and compelling. And I feel like we've done a pretty good job, you know, talking about the weird component and the compelling component of yeah. it. Can you talk to me about like the dangerous
yeah. component? Yeah. This I found so fascinating. So Romans divided their understanding of religions and gods into two categories. And it's not like there was no like document about this, but looking back, the way people use different terms, this seems to be true. Religio, which is the proper worship of the gods, and superstitio, where we get the word superstition, which is out of bounds or dangerous worship of the gods. And so things that qualify. So Rome was actually tolerant when it came to allowing people to worship their ancestral gods, foreign gods, whatever. They thought the more the merrier. If we can get blessed by, you know, Iranian gods and, you know, Mesopotamian gods, so be it. Like, they didn't care. But they wanted to regulate it, and they didn't just let any old religion come in. They wanted to make sure. So they had three things they're looking for. Is it ancient? Is it ritualized, right? And is it controlled? And so for Judaism, for example, got a pass because they say, hey, we go back to the beginning of time. Our God created the whole world. They're like, okay, that's impressive. Ritualized, they say, we got the law of Moses. We got all these rules, all this stuff. They say, great. And then controlled, right? Purity laws, things like, you know, we got priests. This is all controlled. Great. Christians come along. And okay, who's your patron deity? Jesus, he was just born 30 years ago. Okay, that is a strike. Okay, what about rituals? We don't really have those. Even baptism and the Lord's Supper, I'd argue, were not rituals the way that Romans thought of rituals, which is basically appeasement rituals. Now, Jews also didn't do it for appeasement, but they got a pass because they looked a lot like other religions.
Yeah.
And so Christians didn't have the kind of expected rituals like sacrifice. And then controlled. Christians didn't have priests. And this was crazy because you needed a trained or appointed go-between who knew how to take the people's needs and concerns to the divine in a respectful and mediated way. And no one was called a priest in the first century of Christianity. Now you could use that metaphorically, like Paul had a priestly ministry of apostles, but nobody was an actual priest, which was a kind of cultic professional or practitioner. And so I kind of liken it, Caleb, to fireworks today. So I lived in the great Commonwealth of Massachusetts for 6 years, 5 years. And Massachusetts does not allow individual citizens to buy fireworks. And they have a whole website dedicated to this. And their rationale is, if I let Caleb buy a whole bunch of fireworks at Target, he's going to light them off in his backyard and blow off his hand. It's just too dangerous. We need to put fireworks in the hands of trained professionals. Or, you know, I don't know if you have like a made-to-order brick oven place, pizza restaurant near you, but we have one here called Mod Pizza. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like Subway where you choose your toppings, goes on the pizza, and then they put it in the oven. Well, why can't I just put it all together myself, walk over the oven, and slip a pizza in there? Why can't I do that? Liability, right? We have trained people who are wearing the right equipment to take your, you know, broccoli, garlic slices, bacon, and sausage pizza and put it on this tray with a long handle, and they're wearing these, you know, heat-resistant gloves, and they know how to put it in the brick oven without killing themselves. And Romans thought that way. You have to have these controlled, trained mediators. And the Christians just say, you pray to God anytime, pray continuously, right? Jesus is with you. The Spirit is not just close by, it's inside of you. There was nothing more crazy than that. This idea that everybody has the Spirit of the divine directly in them. I mean, how do we not just instantaneously explode? it was just a completely crazy idea. So it was dangerous because you Christians are getting too close to the gods. You're playing with fire. Think about people that get in trouble today for, what is it when you offend a judge? What is that called in court? What's it called? Oh my gosh, there's a term for it. Oh, anyway, it's this idea that you can't just walk up to the judge and say, "Hey, buddy," and sit on his desk or her desk. You know, that is volatile, right? You're going to get in trouble. For the same reason, you know, you don't walk up to a lion on a safari and start petting them, right? It's just too dangerous. And the Christians were doing this. They were getting too close to the gods, to the point where they're saying, "I'm unified with the gods. Christ is in me, and I am in Christ."
Is it contempt? I think it,
Contempt of court.
yeah, yeah,
Contempt
you're
of
being
court. That's it.
contempt of court.
So Romans would say Christians are in contempt of religion.
Yeah.
Religio. But another one, and maybe you'll want to pick up on this, it was the way they talked about people. The kinds of people that they engaged with. Pliny, I mentioned Pliny earlier, he's non-Christian Roman statesman who is investigating Christianity on behalf of the emperor. And he finds two Christians and interrogates them. And this is like, I think, early second century, I think. And these are the three things that we know about these two people he interrogates. They're both deacons, which means they're leaders in the church. They're both slaves. And they're both women. So we have very little concrete data, what we consider factual data, outside of the New Testament for actual Christians and what they were like. We have a just very small amount. We have a little bit of Josephus. We have a little bit in other writings, but we'd have just extremely small amount of information. What we learn from Pliny, who is a very trusted resource because he has no reason to favor Christianity, is they were promoting the wrong kind of people. These are people that you would not promote in society. These are the bottom dwellers in society. And here, they're leaders of the church. That's dangerous because you're messing with the pyramid, right? Christians were volatile for messing with the pyramid.
The last thing that I want to ask you about is, and you know, I'm not asking you to pick your favorite. I'm just asking to pick a favorite.
Oh boy. Oh boy.
Do you have a favorite biblical example of you know, Jesus or the Apostle Paul or one of the other disciples, like, critique of Roman culture?
Good question. Yes. I mean, there's one that immediately comes to mind. So this is the book of Acts where towards the end, where Paul willingly goes to prison. And he gets in the ship and he warns them there's going to be this great storm. Nobody listens. They end up getting shipwrecked on the island of Malta. Is that correct? Yes. And the native people there, the Maltans, are referred to as barbarians. They're referred to as uncivilized island people. One of my favorite critiques of Luke, who wrote this, is you expect barbarians to be uncivilized, to be cannibals or to whatever. And they end up giving hospitality to Paul. And Paul preaches to them and all of that. And then these barbarians, they take care of Paul and they take care of the 270 some prisoners that are with Paul, which is kind of crazy. And then they put Paul on a new ship because his ship was broken, on a new ship back to prison. Luke loves to mess with our categories of who people are, the stereotypes we use for people, the Christian compassion for outsiders, these barbarians. One of the things that scholars bring up, which I'd never thought about until I did a sermon on Acts, I think 27, is calling the barbarians almost presumes they don't speak Latin or Greek. So how did Paul communicate with them? So all this stuff is happening with gestures. I kind of think of like C-3PO with the Ewoks. You know, they're like worshiping him as a god. They're like parading him around. But what I love about that story is the Bible constantly messes with our assumptions of categories, where people belong in what categories. And I know it sounds kind of hippy dippy, but the early Christians really believe that people are people. They're not these kind of people or those kind of people. People are people. So barbarians will surprise you. prisoners will surprise you, right? Romans will surprise you. Greeks will. I love that Luke writes about these things, because even non-Christians, he's saying, these people will surprise you. But it's the Christian thing in the world, the most Christian thing in the world, to give someone a chance. The same chance you give somebody else.
I love that. And I think that's a good place to wrap up. I know that, Nijay, people are going to want to keep up with you and get your new book, Strange Religion. Where's the best place for people to go to do those things?
Yeah, wherever you like to buy books. If you want Kindle, you go to Amazon. But if you're looking for other places, I recommend your local bookstore. And I used to work for CBD, aka ChristianBook.com. That's always a good place to look for discounts. If you're a digital person, Logos Bible software has it. But yeah, and then I always recommend, if people want to follow my work, to listen to the Slow Theology podcast that I co-host with Dr. AJ Swoboda. We continue conversations about the Bible, early Christianity, and the modern church. So follow along if you're interested.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. Thanks for the good conversation, and just thank you for doing the work and continuing to share it with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for reading my book. It's an honor.
So, you know, reflected on my conversation with Nijay, I think one of the things that I'm constantly going to be thinking about from this conversation is how the Roman Empire has influenced us today in terms of how we see class, or how we compare ourselves to other people as well. And, you know, I think the picture that came to my mind for it was being in a sports arena, and how similar that is to the Colosseum as well. And, you know, I'm sure that there's lots of parallels that we can make in that. But that's just one of the ones that came to my mind in that first class example that he talked about as well. So yeah, that, and just the idea of that everybody is somebody, that everybody has value, that everybody is human, and that people don't always fit into neat. We don't always fit into neat categories, even though we have the maybe the tendency and the temptation to do that. That we need to look to see everybody with fresh eyes, that they are their own person. And as much as we maybe think that we can categorize them or sort them or organize them, we can't. They still surprise us. Even, you know, I love how I said, even barbarians can surprise us with their hospitality, or how they differ from the picture in our head as well. So those are a couple of things that I'm thinking about from this conversation. If you enjoyed this, if you want to continue on your lifelong journey for learning, please subscribe to my Substack, to where I, as I mentioned before, I just give many different recommendations of the best things that I'm currently learning about. And again, all you got to do is type in your email, and it will subscribe to it anytime that I send out something great that I love and that I enjoy as well. So I think that's all for me today. I do want to say thank you to Sam Massey for creating the music for this podcast. Thank you again to Dr. Nijay Gupta for being on the podcast as well. And thank you for listening all the way to the end of the episode. My name is Caleb Mason. And until next time, keep learning and keep growing.